Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. It's no secret that American education is in the midst of a profound crisis. Many of our children can't read, do mathematics, or even learn basic life skills. At the same time, many accuse the education establishment of imposing radical ideological views on children, such as gender ideology and anti-Americanism. The good news is that concerted efforts are now underway to reform education to better equip children for adulthood and to be productive members of society. My colleague at the Discovery Institute, Dr. Carrie D. Ingraham, director of the American Center for Transforming Education, has followed these developments closely and has learned opinions about what has gone wrong in education, what is working, and what should be done to improve the system. So I asked her back to Humanize to discuss the issues she thinks are most important for us to understand as a new president is about to be elected. Dr. Ingraham holds a Doctor of Education degree and a Master of Education degree from Regent University. Her undergraduate Bachelor of Arts degree was awarded from George Fox University, where she was named an Academic All-American. Prior to joining the Discovery Institute, she spent nearly two decades leading within the field as a national consultant, requested conference speaker, head of school, virtual and hybrid academy director, administrator, classroom teacher, and athletic coach. Dr. Ingraham has been a guest on Fox News multiple times. Her articles have been published by The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, The Federalist, Real Clear Education, The Washington Times, National Review, The American Spectator, Washington Examiner, The Epoch Times, The Seattle Times, Puget Sound Business Journal, The Daily Signal, and a host of other media outlets. Carrie, welcome back to Humanize.
Thanks, Wesley. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is education so important to human dignity and freedom?
Education's essential. It sets a trajectory of an individual's life. Think about if you're not able to read, how that is going to hinder opportunities and your ability to discover your unique giftings, your passion. So basic education is so foundational to human dignity, human flourishing. And unfortunately, today in America, kids are not getting a high quality education and they're being stifled for life.
You know, that's interesting because if anybody saw us together, they'd know I'm a lot older than you. And I received a very good education in the public schools in the 50s and 60s. There weren't any major controversies that I recall about what was taught. Teachers were well regarded. The schools educated pupils efficiently and the administrators did not make the news. What happened?
As public education has continued to grow because of more and more funding, more and more teachers are hired. And those teachers are members of teacher unions. And so more teachers equals more members, which equals more money going to the teacher unions. Well, the teacher unions have misplaced priorities. And we've seen that over the past several decades where they've leveraged the money that they receive from these employees, these teachers, in the form of dues to fund radical progressives in their political campaigns. And so they help people get elected. And then in turn, they have enormous political power. And so what happens is that those political ideologies are then put back into the classroom at the expense of core academic learning. And so more and more money is the continued cry. And so more and more employees are hired year after year. As just one example, There is three times the number of non-teachers today in K-12 public education than just a few decades ago. And so they are staffing up enormously. And then look at spending.
So are you saying that all this, I mean, we're spending a lot of money in education. You're saying that a lot of it now is going to non-teaching personnel?
Yes, that's where the hiring is happening significantly.
And why, what are they doing? What is this increase? I guess it would be a bureaucracy. What is the increased bureaucracy supposed to accomplish, and why do you think it's hindering education?
Well, when student academic achievement is not on par with what it should be, there's two things that public education claims. One is that they're underfunded, and the other is that they're understaffed. So with more money and more people, they can then educate children better. But it has not played out decade after decade. And just looking at inflation-adjusted spending since the 1970s, it has nearly tripled. Yet student learning has not increased at all. So the solution of more money and more people, it's faulty.
These bureaucrats that are not educators, what are the functions that they're performing?
A host of things. So more and more office staff, a lot more district staff. So people that aren't even on the school campuses, but they're at an offsite district headquarters. Also, just more supervision and support staff. And so, you know, they're saying teachers are overworked. And so they are having more and more people come in to do things that a classroom teacher should be doing to spend time with the kids. But it's because that union control.
And is part of this beyond the union issue, which we'll get into a little bit later, is part of this that there are a lot more regulations, let's say, coming from the federal government that schools must abide by, and so they're hiring people to comply with these regulations?
You know, that's probably like a small piece of it, some of the staffing up due to regulations, but more than anything, it's the notion that if we had more people and we had more money, we could produce better education.
But they're not doing more teachers, which means that the classes aren't smaller, right?
Correct.
And if you don't have smaller classes, how do you improve education?
It's a formula that's disastrous. It is not working.
Well, let's get to the American Center for Transforming Education, which you head. What is the purpose of the center, and what does it seek to transform?
So we're a part of Discovery Institute, the American Center for Transforming Education. We're focused on K-12 education. We work with state government policymakers, parents, educators, business leaders, and other education stakeholders to transform our education system. So specifically, what do we do? We advocate for policies that empower parents, things that allow for innovation within K-12 education, so freeing up from some of those regulations you mentioned, and making sure that kids are equipped with the skills, the knowledge, but also the character that they need so that they can enter into their world, into their community after high school, and be great citizens, but also contribute, that they have skills and knowledge to be productive members of the workforce.
You know, we read a lot, and I'm certainly not an expert in the education field, so I only know what I read in the newspapers to, I think, quote Will Rogers. But our kids are not learning to read. They're not learning arithmetic and mathematics. They're not learning science. I mean, obviously some are, but that the test scores are down, that the proficiency levels, which we talked about at length in the last interview last year, are doing poorly. How does our relatively poor record, apparently, compare with other countries, particularly such as China, which is a major competitor of ours, as well as Europe?
Yes, China ranks much higher than us. The European countries, Singapore, as one example, is always near the top. And how that's figured out is based on what's called the PISA exam. So it's an exam that 15-year-old students around the world take in developed nations every few years. So from the most recent data of U.S. students on this PISA international test, U.S. students are ranking ninth in reading, 16th in science and 34 in math on a world stage. So many implications there. We think about like workforce development, economy, but it's also a national security issue, to your point with China, when we are just not producing citizens that are going to be equipped.
What are these countries that are beating us in terms of education? What are they doing differently than we are to produce better results?
Well, I would imagine and anticipate that they're focused on basic things like reading, writing, math, and also focused on science. But because of that teacher in control, that misplaced priorities, an enormous amount of the school day is eaten up with this radical indoctrination that has nothing to do with core academic learning. So that's an issue. It's also an issue of how we select and train teachers in the United States. So Singapore is one example, which I mentioned earlier, which has top performing students year after year as an exam is given. They have teaching as a high profession. It's a status profession. It's extremely competitive to get into. So kind of think about programs in the U.S. that are really competitive, like medical school programs or going on to become a surgeon. So very difficult to advance. Only a small percentage, the top tier students move forward. Well, that's how it's treated with the teaching profession. And so they get the best and the brightest teachers. And those teachers then get in the classroom and they're rewarded. And so they attract the best because financially they're compensated according to be, you know, the top employees in the country, top workforce. And in turn, they're laser focused on the core academics.
That's very interesting to me. And I think there may be other things at play, again, as a non-expert. One is the cultural differences. I mean, Singapore is a far more regimented society, just as an example, than the United States. China's a despotism. Europe has more communitarian values rather than individualism. Is there something about the U.S. culture, do you think, and this is kind of coming from left field to you, that might adversely or deleteriously impact our kids' ability to learn?
Well, one thing that's been looked at is the length of the school day, as well as the length of the school year. So how much time students in different countries are going to school. And I think that can play into it. You know, with our schedule here in the United States, there's an enormous break in the summer. And so when the kids go back to school in the fall, teachers are having to reteach a lot of the material that was lost over the summer. There's pockets around the U.S. that have moved to a year-round school model where the breaks are between 1, 2, and 3 weeks spread out through the school year. They're seeing great student learning, student retention.
So that has created an improvement, you're saying?
Yes, that has been a significant improvement in those schools that have done that. It's also really helpful for families because they don't have to figure out what to do, you know, for 3 months in the summer to supervise their child, to provide supplemental learning experiences, you know, camps and all types of things. And what those schools are doing that in the year-round model, in many cases, is during those weeks when the kids are off, students that have fallen behind, they're providing the option for those kids to come to school to get caught up.
Oh, that's very interesting.
In a smaller setting. And so that's a great model. We need to see more of it.
So it almost becomes a semi-private tutoring situation if you're behind, or let's say you got sick and couldn't go. This allows you to catch up.
Yes, in a small group setting. And in a few cases, they're actually requiring kids, you know, who are lagging behind to go ahead and come in during those times. So it's different in different places.
Is part of the problem, and I've heard advertisements about this on the radio, so I don't know the facts here, but it seems that they're transforming schools from education centers into community centers, where it's almost like where kids will go to get health care and kids will go to get social services and psychological support and meals. Is that part of the problem, both with the extra staffing and the less emphasis on education?
Well, you really changed gears on me there, because those schools that are doing that extra academic in many cases are against that community school model. So community school model sounds good in theory, But in a lot of cases, community schools have partnered with Planned Parenthood. They've put in health clinics. Some schools are now talking about putting in washers and dryers. So, you know, kids get breakfast, lunch, and in some case, dinner at school. They can.
It's almost a replacement for family, it sounds like.
Yes, and it is not the role of K-12 public education to replace moms and dads, as well as community support. That should come from nonprofit organizations, and it should start with families reaching out to other families in need. It is not the role of the government through education to push moms and dads out. And it's also, to your point, leading to this enormous cost of K-12 education. As one example, here in the state of Washington, during COVID, in many districts across the state, they started providing free lunch and free breakfast to all students. Students that moms and dads could afford it, moms and dads could pack lunches from home. And so the cost just continues to go up, and it's subsidized by taxpayers. So a family that could easily afford lunch for their children no longer pays for it in that form of groceries or sending it from home or paying for hot lunch at school. But now, through just astronomical increases in their taxes, they're covering that lunch, in essence, for their children and for many other children. And so just to continue to grow government bigger and bigger is really problematic.
Is this a reaction, though, to the breakdown of families, where you have a lot of children now living in single family or single parent households, or blended, what they call blended households? You know, the model when I grew up was mom and dad were at home, and generally, I'm not saying this should be the case, but mom stayed at home and made sure that the kids got taken care of, homework was given, there was much more social support from the family. Is part of the school's community outreach to try to make up for a certain collapse in family life?
That's the marketing plan. That's the strategy of how it's communicated out to get buy-in by stakeholders. But from the inside looking out, the driving forces are control, pushing out parents, and putting in some very radical policies and practices that have nothing to do with the education of children, have nothing to do with their best interest. For example, Planned Parenthood, as well as clinics where kids can be prescribed things that will prevent their puberty. So like puberty blockers during the school day without moms and dads knowing. And so while these sound good in theory, these community schools helping families, it is definitely not the intent of those inside the system. It's not an innocent effort.
And what part do you think that social media plays in all of this? Because, you know, kids have much, in fact, I have much lower attention span than I did before social media came online. And from what I read, a lot of kids have their phones at school and are texting back and forth. And that some schools are beginning to experiment with banning smartphones from the classroom. What do you think of that?
It's definitely a needed effort. This fall, when kids went back to school, multiple states had enacted bans to some degree. Florida is one example, on smartphones in the classroom. And other states have just encouraged it. Some have put forth legislation that has not been enacted yet. But kids are coming to school highly distracted, and they to have a phone on them, you know, as an adult, when your phone's by you, every time it vibrates, every time it chirps, how your mind gravitates towards that. We don't have the mental discipline to hear that alert on our phone and not break concentration. And so
it's a good thing that the phone doesn't chirp now, or I might interrupt this interview.
Kids are just getting inundated. There was a study done in the book, The Anxious Generation, that revealed that heavy users of social media, particularly teenage girls, on average get so many alerts per day, notifications, that it can average up to one per minute Really? Every single day, not just when they're awake, but one per minute.
That's so amazing.
You know, as adults, we get a lot, but kids with their social media apps and so many of them, they are just inundated. And so to put away the phones during the school day is a great move. There's other technology that can help with learning in the classroom, other devices, but the phones are really not necessary.
You've been a pretty strong critic of the teachers' unions, and I asked you to give me a list of some of the reasons why, which you kindly did. And one of them that you mentioned is teacher training. How do teachers' unions interfere with proper teacher training?
Yeah, so they control what the teachers are trained in. There was something that happened earlier this year out.
Wait, let me interrupt you. The teachers' unions control it instead of the school boards or the administrators?
Yes, the teacher unions have tremendous power. And so they are able to push their agendas into this teacher training. Earlier this year, we saw in California, there was something called Woke Kindergarten. That's an organization. Listeners can look it up online. Well, a school district in California in the Bay Area spent $250,000 to bring in Woke Kindergarten to educate their teachers. And it was just so absurd because it was at Glassbrook Elementary within the district where there was fewer than 12% of students who were at grade level in English and fewer than 4% of their students at that elementary school were meeting basic proficiency in math. So kids can't read, can't do math. But the teachers aren't trained, you know, in phonics or how to teach math better. They're trained in things like anti-racism and how to disturb whiteness in their classroom. Super ironic because less than 4% of all kids in this elementary school are even white. So why are they spending $250,000 on this when their kids can't learn?
Well, it sounds to me as if they're betraying these children of color. Who will need excellent education if they're going to get ahead in life.
Absolutely. I mean, kids don't need to be pitted against one another under the guise, you know, that they're racist. These are children. Children are loving, children are forgiving, and they're at school to learn core academics. And so teachers should be trained to do a phenomenal job in creating a high quality education for each child every single day during the
school. Sounds like there's a conflict between those who want schools to teach what you said, core education, and those who want to engage in social engineering to create what they would consider to be the proper political and social views. Is that a conflict that you're describing there?
Absolutely. And it comes from, you know, the far left progressive ideology through the teacher unions. And there's a lot of great teachers that care about kids. They go into the profession not to push on these radical ideologies, but they go into the profession because they want to be a great teacher. But to get into the profession, they have to go through a school of education because the teacher unions control who can teach. So they need their teacher certificate. And then those schools of education start the indoctrination of teachers in these woke ideologies and train them to teach those to their kids. And then it just continues. So then they're hired, they go to a district. What's the teacher training that they get, you know, at in-service and throughout the year on professional development days? It's more of that same thing. So it's just taught, it's reinforced, it's this gradual drip. And everyone around them who's been in the system longer is bought into these ideologies. And so you get a system where it's controlled by one viewpoint, but that's at great odds to what moms and dads want for their children.
And do teachers today, I mean, you said that the teachers' unions require teachers to get a certification from a teaching school, not just a university, right? But a teaching school. And the teaching schools have this woke kindergarten approach that they inculcate into the teaching students who are in school to become teachers, which then is brought into the schools. Is that the way that you say this is happening because of the teachers' union?
Yes. And how the teacher unions are able to require that teacher certificate is because they have the enormous political power. So teacher certification, it's governed at the state level, but because of their power, they control the politicians who control those laws, if that makes sense.
One of the other things you said is teacher pay, which I think is interesting because you said that one of the good things Singapore is doing is paying teachers a lot of money. And if that works for them, why wouldn't it work for us?
Well, so in the U.S., how it works for a teacher, again, teacher pay is governed at the state level, but the teacher unions are able to have enormous influence on that. And it's a stair-step salary schedule. So a teacher's poor performance or exceptional performance as a teacher is completely ignored. When you enter as a teacher, you know, you're put on this schedule based upon how many degrees you have. Each year you stay in the system, you get an incremental increase. And you could be the worst teacher, kids not learning, but you're going to get paid more every single year just because you stay in the system. Well, it doesn't attract people that are highly motivated. So in Singapore and other countries, they utilize performance pay, just like other professions do. And so people are incentivized not just to enter the profession because of the higher pay, and it's a top-tier profession, very elite to get into, but then their work is recognized, they're motivated, they've got the incentives right to draw out teachers to provide high-quality student learning, where we just don't.
So the high pay that Singapore accords is based on merit. And the high pay or the pay schedules that we have are based on, to use a maybe not the proper term, time served.
Yeah, seniority schedule.
Yeah, that's interesting. You said that teachers unions have an undue influence when you sent me the note over curriculum. In what regard? Because I always thought that curriculum was determined by either state law or school boards.
It's the same thing. They leverage that enormous political power, just like with the teacher pay, to keep it on a salary schedule. And just like teacher certification, they do the exact same thing with curriculum. They influence it. And so the curriculum that's mandated at the state level, as well as where there's flexibility at the district level, the driver behind that is the teacher unions.
And what do they put in the curriculum that you find objectionable?
There's a host of things. Let's start with just the latest, this rewriting of U.S. history. And so starting from the position as they teach students history to say that America is systemically racist. And racism is the reoccurring theme through which U.S. history is taught. That's not truthful. That's not the foundation of our country. Yes, there was slavery. But our country today is not based on a systemic racism society. And they also say all other institutions are systemically racist.
But you're not saying that we shouldn't teach students that America has a racist history, are you?
Correct. Students need to know history. They need to know the facts. But to push this guise that that's the overarching theme of our entire country today included, is wrong. And they have a rewriting called where they're taking away 1619 and they're saying, you know, America wasn't founded then. They're changing that. And then from there, they go in.
Well, as I understand, I haven't read the 1619 Project, but as I understand it, that's when Jamestown was founded and in that era. And the first slaves were brought, and certainly not American, they were brought by England. To the United States. So the 1619 Project says that from the very first settlement of Europeans on the American continent, racism was an integral part of that. And that's why they are saying the country started in 1619 because we are incorrigibly racist through and through. Is that what you're saying that is being taught, as opposed to the history I learned about? Yes, slavery certainly existed, and you had the revolution, and then you had the Civil War, and there's been this incremental improvement in race relations. Are those the very generally stated the distinctions?
Yes, I'm glad you clarified that as I misspoke. You're exactly right. And then today, what we see activities happening during the school day with children are under the notion of, you know, if you're a white student or an Asian student, you're of privilege, completely irrelevant to the student's unique circumstances. And then if you're a student of color, you're oppressed. And so they're just continuing these themes. They're coming under the guise of ethnic studies. They're now being pushed in subjects.
So rather than healing our divisions, they're exacerbating them again.
Yes, that's a great way to think about it. And they're making it the theme of our country, of really anything that happens. It all comes down to race. It even flows into how students are disciplined at school. There's metrics where districts are rewarded if they meet the certain metrics of having student discipline based on these quotas for race. So if you're too high where students of a certain race are disciplined versus others, you won't get as much funding for not achieving that. And so there's just hyper misplaced priority on race.
You also mentioned in your note to me the ability to keep schools closed to get irrelevant political demands met. So are you saying that the teachers' unions basically hold schools hostage to other political desires that the union may want to see in society?
Yes, we saw this during COVID. Just extreme examples. In Los Angeles Unified School District, the teacher union said that the district will not reopen to serve children until certain demands were met. And those demands, you know, weren't things about safety or healthcare or anything that had to do with COVID. The demands included putting a moratorium on charter schools. So they didn't want students to even go to other types of public schools because those employees are not their teachers of the member of the unions. They also wanted the police to be defunded before they would reopen K-12 public schools to students and Medicare.
Wait a minute. Let me interrupt. You're saying that during COVID, when the schools were closed and people were pushing to have the schools reopen because of the harm closing schools caused to the students, the teachers' union in one locale at least balked because they said, we won't allow the schools to reopen unless you defund the police?
Yes, defund the police, Medicare for all, and a moratorium on charter school. Those were the major demands in Los Angeles Unified School District, but those weren't outliers. In the large school districts around the country, particularly in cities, in blue-run cities, we saw this in New York, Chicago, here in Seattle, where I'm based, they continued to keep kids at home to get these other demands met. Had nothing to do with the education of children, the safety of their member the safety of their teacher members. Completely irrelevant.
So were kids kept out of school longer than they would otherwise have, but for these irrelevant political demands?
Without question. So schools closed down in beginning of March 2020 in states, and we saw by fall, private schools around the country reopened. They asked the parents, their customers, they polled them, they asked for input, and families wanted their kids back in school. And then for families that weren't quite ready, so in some cases, a small portion of school families, 5 to 10% on average in private schools, said, you know, we're not quite ready. We want to wait another semester. You know, maybe the child had an autoimmune, you know, condition or such, or a grandparent living at home. So a lot of those schools quickly created an online option in addition to opening in full. So they said, we're going to serve our families. That was in the fall of 2020. They proved it was safe. There wasn't huge outbreaks. And in some states, public schools, because of these teacher union demands, held out spanning 3 school years to reopen schools.
I'm sorry, 3 years?
Span 3 school years. So it started in 1920 with the closure there.
2020.
Yes, but started the 1920 school year. Yeah. So that school year, and then the 2021 school year, and then the 21-22 school year. So it spanned 3 different school years. That is so significant in the education of a child.
And from what I've read, these kids who were kept out of school and were doing online learning, supposedly, really suffered serious educational consequences. Can you state what some of those were?
Yes, and I think it's important to distinguish that what those public schools provided during COVID, the prolonged school closures, really wasn't online learning. So online learning is where teachers are trained to deliver it that way. The curriculum's designed. Students, it's a great fit for them to learn online. These were haphazard remote Zoom sessions where the curriculum wasn't designed for it. Families hadn't chosen it. The teachers weren't trained in how to deliver it. And so that was really problematic just in the format and the haphazardness. But what was happening was kids were just not learning, and they saw that. And so they started to lower academic standards. And so things were that typically would be graded moved to completion grades simply if you turn it in. Then the standard was further lowered, where as long as you did some of it and turned it in, you would still get a completion grade. And then they decided that testing wouldn't be fair. It wouldn't be fair to test these kids. And so testing didn't happen, whether it was within a certain subject, you know, like the end of semester test or the unit test. Well, and then in some places, they didn't do standardized testing. And so they continued to just lower the level, but yet students didn't receive low grades. You know, kids that weren't turning things in, that weren't learning on grade level, they were still getting A's and B's. And so parents had no idea that their child was so significantly behind academically because they weren't getting test data, but yet their kids were getting report cards that were showing, you know, just like everything's okay, your students get an A or a B. And so that's been so detrimental. And it's just continued now, the lowering of these standards.
You know, I have a personal story about how I can understand how the kids may have had good grades but didn't learn. When I was in eighth grade, the teacher lost control of the class. And we really, you know, eighth graders can be real socially Darwinistic, right? And so we took advantage of that and we mocked him and we were really out of control. And rather than rein us in, the administration, maybe it was a new philosophy, basically kind of didn't exercise the discipline they should have. And this teacher would allow us to do extra credit, which was puff stuff, to get good grades. So I got an A in math, but I wasn't proficient in math. And when I tried to take algebra, it became very clear that I wasn't ready in freshman algebra in high school for algebra because I never learned really the eighth grade math requirements to prepare me for high school, even though I got straight A's in math. So I never caught up. I mean, I never caught up with that. That's one of the reasons I chose to be a lawyer. I couldn't do math the way I once had been able to. But I just have a personal experience from many years ago, how this could happen. And if you did that on Moss, I can imagine you've got who knows how many students who are years behind in their proficiency. And by the time they get to university, may not be able to do that. Or even when they enter the trades, they may not have the skills which are still required as a tradesman or tradeswoman. So it's been a terrible disservice to our children. And you're saying a lot of this was in the cause of politics in addition to the fear of the disease.
Yes. And you touched on something really important there about, you know, kind of that loophole of a bunch of extra credit when you're not learning the basics. Well, what we've seen skyrocket during COVID is the social emotional learning. And so kids are getting asked questions on their core academic assessments that don't have to do with math or reading or whatever the subject is, but it's things like, how do you feel about how you did on this? And that's counted, that's scored, no matter what they put down as a point, and there's multiple. So I was helping a student, upper elementary student, with his math during COVID. It was on the computer, you know, because schools were closed. This was in a public school in the state of Washington. And he had two or three math questions on this assessment. And then I don't remember exactly how many, but at least four or more. So heavier weighted questions about, how do you feel about your math learning? You know, is there anything bothering you right now in your life? Like these fishing questions And so even if he got the math questions wrong, he would still get a passing grade for putting anything down. He said, I just have to put something in that box and it will count.
How do you feel about 2 + 2 = 4? That's really, you know, some subjects would be more subjective, but certainly math should be objective.
Yes, and not having these questions, you know, so focused on like almost having kids kind of self-diagnose, constantly asking them like, how do you feel about this? How are you doing?
So no wonder they're all so emotionally distraught. I mean, they're being taught that feelings matter more than thought.
Well, yes. And, you know, students gain confidence when they work hard, and then the reward, you know, think about athletics. There's a lot of sweat that goes into it, a lot of time, a lot of dedication. You know, you're corrected by your coach. Sometimes, you know, you're disciplined by your coach. But the payoff of achieving, it's just that sweet success. And that's the same for kids with learning. You know, reading's not easy. But when it clicks and they're able to read, they feel great about themselves. But we've switched that. And so instead of teaching kids these core academics, we're not teaching them. And then there's this hyper focus of trying to make up for it and saying, you know, well, how are you doing? You know, is everything okay? Are you not feeling good about yourself? You know, maybe we should check on, you know, are you depressed? Are you feeling suicidal? And we're putting all these ideas in their head.
Maybe we should medicate you.
Yes, all these ideas.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, hey, we are an academic institution. We're here to teach you the basics, and we're going to do a great job of that. And you're going to thrive academically, but as a person.
When you build a house, the house isn't going to stand if you don't have a solid foundation. So you're saying that the foundation isn't being laid.
Correct.
Let's. We could go on in this stuff for a long time, but let's move on to some other issues. Parental involvement. You know, I hate to play old times week, but when I was growing up, parents were really involved, particularly in the elementary school I went to. My mother was the president of the PTA. I remember that very clearly. We had carnivals to raise money for the school. We had newspaper drives where there'd be these big stacks of newspapers that were sold to people who collected the newspapers for whatever purpose. And there was a true partnership between families and among parents and the school administration and the teachers. Today, that doesn't exist in the same fashion. I've seen stories, and correct me if I'm wrong, where in some regard, teachers, in some regard, parents are viewed by the educators and the educational establishment as kind of interlopers and the enemy. Am I right about that?
Yes, sadly, that's where we are today. And so what happened during COVID, when schools reopened for in-person instruction, parents were no longer allowed to enter into these public schools. So they were saying, you know, because of COVID, yes, the kids are back, but we can't have any parents pass the office. We can't increase the amount of people on our campus in the name of safety. Well, that has continued now. You know, COVID is in the rearview mirror. It is not detrimental to allowing a parent to go into a child's classroom. But that policy has been to keep parents out. Also, in the name of school safety, saying, you know, parents, you can't go into classrooms. We just can't have any adults that don't have badges. Well, look at how private schools do it. A parent can check in. You know, they show their driver's license. They get a sticker badge that they can wear, identifies who they are. There's very easy ways to make it safe for moms and dads to be in schools. But they're using these false guises to keep parents out. And it's such a detriment to the education of children. Parents,
and we're talking about, in addition to, I mean, I think every listener's probably read the stories or heard the reports about teachers keeping a child with gender dysphoria, their desire to be a different sex than they were born, secret from parents. But you're talking about well beyond that particular issue, correct?
Correct. Even just getting on campus. And moms and dads are the number one factor. Number one influence of student achievement is the parent. Now, the teacher is number one at school influence, but overall, it's moms and dads. We need them involved.
Of course. And you know, they're part of the educational, you know, mom, I can't work out this math test. Or dad, what do you think about this history lesson? I remember reading a couple of weeks ago a story about a judge. There was a lawsuit trying to force a school, I think it might have been New Jersey, but I'm not sure, to reveal what the curriculum was to the parents. And the judge said, no, the school does not have to do that. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not familiar with that example, that specific example, but those things are happening where even, you know, what is being read in libraries, assignments given to kids, parents are concerned. They'll go to a school board meeting and they'll start talking about it, or they'll have the example, they'll read the worksheet, they'll open the book and read the book given to their child. And their mic is cut off because it's that inappropriate. An adult can't read it to another adult or say those words in a public forum. But yet the children are getting these materials without.
So they're being sexualized in school. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And just so extreme that, you know, as it's exposed, they don't remove those materials. They just double down.
Sexuality when you're growing up is enough of a problem without it being force-fed you through quasi-pornographic, quote, educational materials. What about absenteeism? Do we enforce truancy anymore?
Well, when schools were shut down for so long and kids saw that showing up for their teachers was non-essential, their teachers could stay at home, you know, they were forced to stay at home. There was just a new view, you know, it's not that important if I go to school. Why can't I just, you know, look at it on the computer? And so student chronic absenteeism has skyrocketed since 2018 to 2020. It's jumped from just 15% of students having chronic absenteeism to over 28%. And it's defined as a student missing 10% of school days or more is chronic absenteeism. Looking at
And you're not talking about, you know, some students get very ill. And that can't be avoided. That's not what you're talking about, correct?
Those students would be within the number, but 28% of students, you know, there's not that many students that are chronically ill comparative to that huge number. And then among students that are low achieving, so the students that really need to be at school the most, the ones that are behind, that number of chronic absenteeism on average across the nation currently is at 36%. So 36% of kids that really need to be at school to catch up in their learning are absent a significant
portion. Are there any efforts to try to make sure they go to school?
There's efforts. I know administrators have, you know, they've tried calling. Sometimes they'll go to the home to check on the situation. But they've created a culture of saying, you know, school's really not that essential because the schools kept kids at home. Like I said, in some states spanning three school years. And so they've built this mindset among kids that showing up is really not that important.
What's happening with discipline in the schools? Because as I told you, my anecdote in the eighth grade, all discipline was lost and it hurt us. More than the teacher was humiliated, but we had a learning setback and I never caught back up in math. If that could happen in that particular kind of isolated circumstance back in years ago, I'm not going to say how many. If there's not discipline today, what's that doing to the kids?
You know, you add in the absenteeism, the low academic standards, the grade inflation, the distractions of the cell phones, the behavior, and then just hyper-focus on social-emotional learning. And schools are just, they're not academic centers anymore because of all those distractions. And then when there is discipline, instead of just being black and white consequences, it's looked at under the lens of race. You know, well, this student's behavior is justifiable because of their race. And so their discipline is not going to be the same as this other student based on race, because the school also wants to meet those metrics. So when students know that they can get away with something, they're going to keep doing it. And just human nature, they're going to do it more and they're going to push the envelope. And that is such a disservice, not just to them because they're missing out on learning and a great experience, but they're taking away the opportunity from other students to have a safe, great school experience.
Well, now that I'm totally depressed, let's talk some solutions. I know you're a big supporter of the school choice movement. What is the, generally speaking, the school choice movement, and what are the different forms that alternative approach can take?
Yes, because the fastest way and the most effective way to reform public education with all of these problems we've touched on is to create a free market solution, to give families the option to select the school that's going to best serve their child, that's going to provide quality academics, and a school that's going to align with their values and not political indoctrination. And so in order to create a free market system for parents, you know, who don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars over a K-12 experience to pay for private school tuition for their child, or the feasibility to homeschool, we need to have programs at the state level where they can use a portion of their child's taxpayer-funded money to select an alternative. And so when parents can leave the public system, when they are empowered, it puts incentives on the public system to reform. So instead of trying to do this legislatively and, you know, take the power from the teacher unions and change all of these things, you know, it's an uphill battle, but instead, bottom up, use free markets. Let parents pick a school. And when they leave, there's market competition. Byproducts of market competition drives innovation, lowers costs. And those other providers are going to have to deliver because they have customers that are bringing them funds. And those customers are so empowered. If they don't, they'll go elsewhere.
So I've heard of a movement in the States where the money, instead of going to the school, it follows the student. And if the student is enrolled in a private school, whatever the portion of the money that would have gone to the public school will instead go to the private school, either paying for all or part of it. That's one approach, right?
Yes. So specific school choice programs, there's school scholarships. So historically, those were considered vouchers. Vouchers, that word's gotten a bad rap. So it's best to think of it as a scholarships where the families get the funds to use for a private school. But there's been a push over the last 4 years on something called education savings accounts. And that would be where parents are given a portion of their child's state and local funding. In Arizona is one example where they enacted universal school choice in 2022, the first in the nation. Families receive between $7,000 and $8,000 in an education savings account if they apply for that. And so they can spend the money not just on a private school tuition, but maybe they want to homeschool. Maybe they don't want their child to go to a hybrid school, micro school, private tutors, online, whatever it is. They can use that. It's very customizable. And anything they don't use out of that $7,000 to $8,000 dollar education savings account, they can save for their child's college. So they're incentivized to stretch that money to be good stewards. In turn, Arizona public schools, just looking at how much funding they receive from state and local, every year it's $12,000. But when you add a couple more thousand in for federal funding, it's about half. So it's like $15,000 versus the $7,000 to $8,000. So about half that parents get. So enormous savings to the state. But parents like education savings accounts because it's so flexible for any education avenue.
Do we have these experiments proceeded for enough time to know whether or not the academic achievement desired has been met? I mean, have they worked to improve scores, for example, on tests and so forth?
So looking back, even before universal, so widespread school choice was in place, school choice programs historically, even though they were really small, you know, maybe just 1% of students in a state were eligible, they consistently had students achieve better academic outcomes as a result of school choice. Another metric we can look at historically is how private school students have performed year after year compared to their public school counterparts. When we look at now the universal school choice that has been enacted in 12 states over the last few years, a lot of times we don't just have the data yet because the standardized testing, you know, was dropped for a period. And so you're not able to have a benchmark to compare. In other cases, you have the data, but some students were locked out of school for 3 years. Then they moved into the school choice program. So they already were so far behind. But then other kids came over right away. And so it's going to be a few years till we get enough data to show, but all of the indicators historically as well as currently is that these programs produce significantly higher academic outcomes for students.
What's the difference between that kind of, you know, you can use a scholarship to pay a private school, whether it's religious or secular, as my understanding, versus a charter school, versus a public school? A charter school is a public school, but it's a different beast of public school, correct?
Correct. And so you've got traditional public schools, which are district public schools. Those are the ones that are teacher union controlled. But then there's public charter schools. And a public charter school is where it is freed up from some of the regulations. So they don't have to have all teachers certified. They have some flexibility in teacher pay. And because of that, they're able to get some highly qualified teachers. They're able to keep those teachers because of the incentives. And they also have some flexibility with the curriculum. And those charter schools consistently are having higher student academic outcomes, but they only receive a portion of the public school funding. And so when a student leaves a district public school to go to a public charter school, some of their funding still stays in the district public school. So district public schools should like this, you know, more money for less students. But because they're losing the student, it can equate to having fewer students at the school. So they need less employees, less teacher union pay. So that's why the unions are against charter schools. But charter schools are a great option for families, and they cost the state less money.
You know, the idea that we're not deciding what's best for the kids, but what's best for the educational establishment is pretty concerning to me.
Yes, it's really focused on an adult system versus a student system.
That's really a betrayal of the whole purpose of education. We're you know, I could go another hour with you, and if you're not careful, I will. But we're basically out of time. But I do have a question for you. As we're taping this, the presidential election has not yet been decided. I mean, people are still voting, and the election's a couple of weeks away. President Trump says he's going to do away with the Department of Education. Vice President Harris is a supporter of the Department of Education. That's one of the big distinctions in this debate, in this election, in terms of differences of policy. I don't want you to talk about who you might vote for, but I do want to know what your thoughts are about the Department of Education. What is the purpose of the Department of Education from the federal government? And do you think that it's providing positive, negative, or both in terms of helping students?
Well, education for K-12 was designed to be governed at the state level. But as the Department of Education has continued to grow over the last few decades, they now have over 4,000 employees. What that has translated to is a waste of so much money that could be better utilized at the state level for education. It's also translated to so much bureaucracy, so much regulation, and those misplaced priorities are pushed down from the Department of Education onto states that are not in favor of those policies. So doing away with the U.S. Department of Education is desperately needed. It will help the education of children, but it also would provide more accountability for the states to deliver effective education. And so moving away from that is great. Now, there's some things that the Department of Education does that you might want to keep in place, but those could all fall under a variety of different federal agencies.
Do you have an example of something that you might want to keep?
You know, some of the protections for maybe students with disabilities, things like that, those aren't necessarily, you know, regulations or things that you would want to get rid of. But they could be under a different department to be better utilized. But a 4,000 employee department is just not needed when K-12 Ed should be at the state level.
So it's your opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you think that education would be more efficient and more tailored to the local circumstance without the Department of Education?
Yes. And look back prior to the Department of Education, student learning has not improved as a result of the Department of Education. Our students are no better off academically today than they were before its inception.
If you could make one change to improve education, just one, what would it be?
Education freedom, allowing every parent to have the opportunity to select the education that's going to best serve their child, because the free market conditions will benefit all students, even students who remain in traditional public schools.
Well, Carrie, thank you very much for being with me today. I'm not part of, I don't have children, so I'm not in the educational situation, but I do read about it, and I am concerned about it, because the future depends on a population that has good quality education, whether it's in professions, whether it's in teaching, whether it's in the trades, or whatever it might be. And I think the work you're doing with the center is really important. And I've been following you, and I have to say, I'm quite impressed.
Thanks, Wesley.
Well, thanks for being with us. And we'll talk to you again perhaps next year. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.